Computer. So it is now recording, and I will turn it over to Harold.
Okay, I'm Harold Williams, the president of NCA. And before I introduce John, who will introduce our speaker, John is, of course, our excellent vice president. For the good of the order, so they continue here. Jack, do you want to tell us about what the Mid-Atlantic Senior Physics Group is going to do later in the month?
Yes. Thank you. I'm Jack Yaffe. I'm the chairman of the APS Senior Physicist Group. We will have a talk next Wednesday, February 17 at 1 p.m. It is a Zoom meeting. There is a link, an announcement, and a link on the page 7 of Stardust. I'll join it. The talk will be volcanoes, calderas, and eruptions, what we know and what we don't know, given by Jacob Lowenstern from the U.S. Geological Survey in Seattle. One of the wonderful things about Zoom meetings, yeah, you can get people from all over. So everyone is welcome to join. As I said, there is a link to the abstract and to the Zoom meeting on page 7 of Stardust. Thank you.
Now, does anybody else have an announcement? Yes, Sue.
Yes, Astronomical Society of Greenbelt meeting on the 25th. We're going to be hearing about a part of NASA that's very critical and a lot of people don't know about, namely the Katherine Johnson IV&V facility in Fairmont, West Virginia. So I think in the spirit of February, it's appropriate in that that was recently renamed a couple years ago after Katherine Johnson of Hidden Figures fame. So it should be interesting to see what goes on there.
Thank you, Sue. I'd actually join if you'd ever have your meetings other than Tuesdays or Thursdays when I generally teach.
That's the way they are. We
I know. You can't change meeting time for one person.
We sometimes record, although we had a really neat one last month from Green Bank and forgot to record it, unfortunately. But
oh, Jay.
At what time does the meeting start?
It's at 7:30 when the Zoom schedule is set up. I will send it out on groups.io.
Thank you, Sue. Say, does anybody else have any announcements that I...
Mita, I think Mita had a question for the group. Mita?
Ask your question. We may know the answer.
Hello, can you see me?
Yes.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay, so I'm a high school physics teacher and I lead the space club. And I have two captains who are going to be rising seniors, and they are super interested in trying to find summer internships. And I was just going to reach out to the group and see if you had any leads. Both of them seem very frustrated that a lot of the internships, both paid and unpaid, seem to be geared towards college students, which, you know, is the way it goes, right? But anyway, so it was just kind of a quick reach out. If, you know, Elizabeth said what I should do is have the kids hone what they want to do and then kind of go through the faculty directories and our local universities, which is a great suggestion. But if any of you have other ideas, I have one of the captains is super interested in rockets. He is like following, he knows more about, you know, Holman transfers and Kerbal space program or whatever than like anybody I know. and Piper, who's the other captain, she is very interested in something called quantum computing, which she led a session on. And I sort of said, sure. So they're both very interested and very knowledgeable, very competent. So anyway, that's my question.
Can I ask, are you around here in the Washington area?
Yes, yes. So I'm a teacher at the Murray School, which is in the district, okay. A small private school. So there you have it. If anybody has any ideas, I sure would be grateful, because I do want to support them. And I feel as if eventually these two kids are going to do amazing things. And there you go.
Try the NASA Goddard Space Flight Center. They do have intern programs. I don't know what their status is for this year.
So Arjun actually tried that, and apparently it's all pretty much for college students. I mean, that seems to be the you know, and I get it, you know, like I totally get it. But anyway, so that's why I was gonna bring it up. So if anybody has any ideas.
Hi, I would like to suggest the Applied Physics Lab. We actually do have a program interns for focus or for high school students.
Oh, wonderful. Oh, that's great.
So I know the applications are, the deadline's coming up soon. So you can go to jhuapl.edu.
J-H-U-A-P, I'm scribbling here.
Okay, yes. jhuapl.edu.
Okay.
And if you go into, I think, the career section, they'll have an internship section there. And we have programs from middle schoolers all the way to grad students and postdocs. And there's a program that's just for high school students.
I really appreciate that. Thank you very much. Thank you.
Okay. And I'm Richard Hubbard. I'm retired from the Naval Research Laboratory. And NRL also has a summer intern program for high school students. Unfortunately, the deadline has already passed, so I can't help you this year, but I will put my contact information in the chat. NRL also does a lot, has lots of opportunities for college students. The problem with NRL is that because it is a military research lab, it needs lots of lead time because our security folks do a background check on everyone. So I will,
of course,
I will put my contact information. Can't help you probably this year, but maybe next year.
Well, thank you. The club is going to go strong, I'm sure, next year. So I appreciate it. Thank you very much, everybody. I really appreciate this. Thank you.
I know Goddard did, at least used to have high school interns. So, but I've been away from there for a couple years now, and plus with the pandemic.
I think the pandemic has really impacted a lot of the internships. But thank you very much. I will forward.
Let me add one thing too. You might try. National Space Society. It may be late for anything, but in the future, here in Washington, D.C., the National Space Society.
Thank you. I had not heard of that. Thank you very much. Yeah. Huh. Okay. Wow. This is great.
So quickly, yes. I put the link to the STEM program also on the chat. The high school program is called the Aspire program, and I double checked. And the deadline is February 28th due to the pandemic. So your students have time to go and apply.
All right. Thank you very much. Appreciate it. Thank you.
Are there any other announcements before I turn it over to John? Okay, John, take it away.
It's a very great pleasure to welcome our speaker this evening, Professor Eliza Kempton, who is an expert on the atmospheres of planets that orbit other stars. She has a bachelor's in physics from Middlebury College in Vermont and a PhD in astronomy at Harvard University. But there's something noteworthy about her early career. Most people in the sciences don't have their first scientific publication until they're well along in graduate school, often working on their doctoral thesis. But by the time Eliza graduated from Middlebury, she already had a publication for work on a quite advanced topic in solid state physics, done at the National High Magnetic Field Laboratory at Florida State University. The very next year, while still at Middlebury, she co-authored a paper on the results of a complicated calculation of how radiation propagates in the solar atmosphere for a rather complicated kind of radiation where there are a couple of spectral lines. And she compared the calculation to the data. And that kind of calculation transferred from the sun to exoplanets perfectly fitted her for what's her long-term research interest. She previously served as a NASA Sagan postdoctoral fellow at the University of California in Santa Cruz, and then joined the physics faculty at Grinnell College in Iowa. And she's now a member of the astronomy faculty at the University of Maryland. As I hinted, her research is focused on detecting and classifying exoplanets. And she's particularly interested in theoretical modeling of the atmospheres of the planets known as super Earths. Dr. Kempton.
There we go. I'm muted. Thank you so much, John, and thank you for the invitation to speak to you all tonight. Let me share my screen. Okay. Hopefully, you can all see my talk slides. Okay. So that was a lovely introduction and a really nice kind of view of my career trajectory, starting with modeling the atmosphere of the sun as an undergrad, but that did transition into modeling atmospheres of exoplanets when I was a PhD student, and that's what I've continued doing to this day. So I'm going to talk to you tonight about the atmospheres of extrasolar planets that are called super Earths. And I will get into what that all means as we get started. I can advance my slides. There we go. Okay, so I just got a lecture before the start of this talk about how we should not say our solar system, we should say the solar system. But here we are at home in the solar system. And those of you in the audience, probably most of the people in the audience, if I would guess, and anyone born before about 1990 remembers the time when we only knew of one planetary system, and that is our own, the solar system. So here it is. The distance is not drawn to scale, but the sizes should be to scale. The solar system, as we know it, is a place of relative order. Right? We have two classes of planets. We have close-in planets in our solar system that are the terrestrial planets. They're primarily made of rock with thin atmospheres. And then we have the gas giants and ice giants, planets that are primarily or that have very substantial gaseous atmospheres made up of primarily hydrogen and helium. And those reside in the outer solar system. And this was kind of, but before we discovered any extrasolar planets, this was our picture of what planetary systems look like. And we might have expected that this is what all planetary systems perhaps would look like. We were wrong, and we will get there in a moment. But first I wanna do a quick introduction to how it is that we find and detect exoplanets around other stars. The first kind of thought exercise that I want you all to go through is to imagine that we're not here on Earth in an ice storm in DC, but instead we're on a planet, a hypothetical planet, orbiting our nearest star, Alpha Centauri, or Proxima Centauri, if you would like. Anyways, you're sitting on this planet orbiting this other star. You gaze out at the night sky. It looks kind of like the night sky that we're all used to. And you see this distant star in the sky. It's fairly bright. And that star is the sun. And you want to look at the sun and be able to determine whether there are planets in orbit around the sun. And this sounds like maybe this is a rather straightforward endeavor, right? You point your telescope at the sun and there are the planets, you just see them. But that is practically a very challenging thing to do. This is a kind of artist conception done by the National Geographic trying to illustrate why this is such a hard thing to do. And they actually really underestimate exactly how difficult it is to image a planet orbiting a distant star. But the way that the analogy that they want to make is that it's like trying to detect a tiny little firefly next to a huge bright spotlight. And that's a good analogy, except that it's much, much, much harder than this. Many, many, many orders of magnitude harder than this. The Earth next to the sun in infrared light is a factor of 10 to the 15 fainter than the sun, or what, a million billion times fainter than the sun. And its light would anyway just be blended in with the light from the sun. So you being able to just image an exoplanet orbiting any of the stars in the sky is extremely challenging. And so instead, astronomers have learned to be quite clever. Instead of trying to image and directly see, directly detect these exoplanets, instead we resort to indirect detection methods where we basically observe just the star that the planet is orbiting around, and we somehow infer the presence of a planet in orbit. So I'm just going to focus right now on one of the detection methods that has been very successful for finding exoplanets, and that's the so-called transit method. The way this works is if you have a planetary system that is lucky enough to be aligned just right relative to us, that planet will pass right in front of its host star as it goes around in its orbit. And then it'll swing back around and pass in front of the star again. That little eclipse when the planet is in front of its star, that's called a transit. We don't actually see, right? We don't image the planets. We don't see the planet move across the face of the star. We don't see this, what's happening in this top panel. Instead, we just observe the brightness of the star at different times. And so we can make this measurement of the brightness of the star versus time. And we see that the star periodically dims by a very small amount every time the planet goes in front of it. All right, and this allows us to, by measuring the amount by which the star has dimmed, this allows us to infer the size of the planet, its radius, say. If you have a Jupiter-sized planet transiting in front of a sun-like star, that's going to block out about 1% of the light from that star. An Earth-sized planet being much smaller only blocks out about 0.01% of the light from a sun-like star, 1% of 1% of the light from a star. And that is a much more challenging measurement to make. So in general, rule of thumb from moderately sized ground-based telescopes, we can detect 1% dimming. So we can detect giant planets transiting sun-like stars. From the ground, we cannot readily do Earth. We don't have the precision to measure transits of Earth-like planets in front of sun-like stars. So to detect transiting Earth-like planets, we end up having to launch space missions to get at those planets observe from above Earth's atmosphere. Okay, and if we've, the transit technique is great because it gives you the size of the planet. There's another technique that I'm not gonna go into too much right now, but there's another technique called the Doppler technique, which allows you to measure the mass of the planet. And if you have those two quantities, the mass of the planet and its size, then you can calculate the planet's density. And the great thing there is that once you've measured the planet's density, you know something about the actual composition of that planet, right? A low density planet is maybe a gas giant planet. It's made of primarily gas, low density material. A high density planet is maybe made of high density material like rock, or even, you know, rock and iron, say. So these are our first hints of what some of these exoplanets are made of. All right, so now getting back to the history lesson. So this is a diagram. This is a graph of planet mass versus orbital distance, semi-major axis in so orbital distance in astronomical units. So Earth is located at 1 AU away from the sun. And this is all of the known exoplanets, or sorry, this is all of the known planets, period, as of 1995. So we knew of all the solar system planets, and the very first exoplanet around a sun-like star was detected in 1995. The planet is called 51 Peg B. It was found through not the transit technique, but the Doppler technique, so it's shown in black. And this was the first hint that exoplanets were perhaps going to be very different from the solar system planets, right? Here's our solar system again, the place of relative order. We have our low mass planets orbiting close to the sun. We have our massive planets, high masses orbiting at greater orbital distances. And now here's 51 Peg B. It's a giant planet. It has a high mass like the giant planets, but it orbits incredibly close to its host star, much closer in than any of the planets in our own solar system. So we now call this kind of planet a so-called hot Jupiter. It's a creative name, right? It's a Jupiter-sized planet or a Jupiter-mass planet orbiting very close into its host star. So it's very highly irradiated and it's very hot. So we call it a hot Jupiter. And we found many of these planets now. So now we'll, one more piece of history. Last year, or I guess now 2 years ago, 2019, the Nobel Prize in exoplanets went to this discovery of the first exoplanet around a sun-like star. Didier Queloz and Michel Mayor, who were responsible for that first discovery, were given a Nobel Prize for launching a whole new field of astronomy that has really matured, and we'll get a little bit farther into everything that has happened in that field ever since then, further into the talk. All right, so now we step forward to today. This is now the diagram of all of the known exoplanets with measured masses and orbital distances. And you can see that the population of exoplanets does not strongly resemble the solar system, does not strongly represent the solar system planets. We do not have these two groupings of planets showing up. Instead, we have planets with all manner of properties. The exoplanet population seems to have very diverse properties overall. I should point out that all of our different exoplanet detection techniques are biased in different ways. So actually it turns out that none of our techniques are actually very good at finding planets over in this corner of the diagram. And that's why you don't see planets in there. It's not necessarily because these objects don't exist around other stars. It's that we can't detect them yet. But in the regions where we can detect planets, we find planets with all manner of properties. And so now the challenge is really to understand how planets form and how planets evolve such that they result in such an interesting and diverse population. I see that a hand went up. Should I answer a quick question now? I'd be happy to do that.
Hi. That diagram appears to have essentially two different populations, one for Doppler and microlensing and one from transit. Is that just bias in the detection techniques?
Yes, yeah, primarily. So that's actually, that's a really important point to make here. Any structure that you see in here is you have to be pretty careful in interpreting it, because it's a combination of biases in the different detection techniques and the properties of the underlying planets. So for example, the transit technique is much, it's much more likely to find planets that are very close into their host stars, which is why all the transiting planets tend to have these very small semi-major axis values. Some of the other structure in here is perhaps real, like there's not a lot of planets in here. That is probably a real effect. But yes, to back out the intrinsic properties of the exoplanet population, you have to be quite careful and understand all the biases that go into the detection techniques in the first place. So a main point that I want to make here, though, because this talk, as I said at the beginning, is about super Earths. Here are the super Earths. Super Earths are, this is the name that I'm going to give to planets with masses or sizes between that of Earth and Neptune. So this is a population of planets that doesn't exist in our solar system, right? These are the planets in between the terrestrial planets and the giant planets. And there's many of them. And we don't know what they are because they're not in our solar system. So this is a very exciting, fundamentally new class of planet to try to investigate. And by understanding their nature, hopefully this will tell us something really fundamental about how planets form and evolve. Okay, so getting back to Jeff's question now, we are able to do the exercise of backing out what the intrinsic population of planets looks like, because we do have an understanding of what the biases in our detection methods look like. And so this is the result of that exercise. When we back out the fraction of stars with planets of a given size or a given mass, what we find is that smaller planets are much more common. They're harder to detect with all of our detection techniques. But when we back out what fraction of stars have these planets, it turns out that these smaller planets are much, much more intrinsically common than the larger planets, at least for planets that are on close in orbits, the ones that we've actually been able to detect so far. And this leads to a really nice quote. This is from a review article that was in Science a few years ago, and it's a really nice summary quote. The most common class of planetary system detectable today consists of one or more planets approximately 1 to 3 times the Earth's size orbiting within a fraction of the Earth-Sun distance. And so we tend to find when we have instruments that are capable of detecting these planets, we tend to find systems with multiple planets in this super Earth size range, planets that are a little bit bigger than Earth, but not as big as Neptune. And these planets are quite common. So now we want to understand them a bit better. Oh, and when we look at this occurrence rate plot a little bit more carefully, this is a more careful analysis of what I was showing on the previous slide. So this is again basically number of planets per star or fraction of stars that have a planet of a given size. But this is a very careful analysis of all of the planets that were found by NASA's Kepler mission. And what we see is it's not just a simple rise towards the smaller sizes. There's actually two groups. There's a peak for there's a population of planets with sizes less than about 1.5 Earth radii. And then there's another population, a separate distinct population of planets with radii between 1.8 and say 3 Earth radii, still smaller than Neptune, right? So the giant planets of our solar system all live out here. And the terrestrial planets in our solar system live here. So these two peaks are again populating a part of the planetary parameter range that just doesn't exist in our solar system. So why are there two peaks? We don't really know, but we think we have an interpretation that these are two different kinds of planets, that these smaller ones represent the rocky planets, basically the real super Earths, the big terrestrial planets, the big rocks. And then the second hump, we think, represents the tail of the giant planet distribution, that these are planets with gas-rich, hydrogen-rich envelopes, atmospheres, and these are like mini Neptunes or sub-Neptunes, that these are more like mini gas giant planets. But this interpretation is still tentative, right? Because it's only based on measurements of the sizes of the planets and what that population looks like. We'd like to go and characterize individual objects and look at the atmospheres of these individual planets to see if this picture all fits, and to do more detailed studies as well. So this is really the goal of studies of exoplanet atmospheres. We want to go out and obtain high quality spectra. So we want to do spectroscopic characterization of exoplanets, and what that allows us to do by measuring the light emitted or absorbed at individual wavelengths across the spectrum. This is going to allow us to constrain the composition of exoplanet atmospheres, the thermal structures, and what I mean by that is how temperature varies as a function of altitude and latitude and longitude around the planet, and also cloud properties, cloud or haze properties in planetary atmospheres as well. So we want to get at these, really primary properties of exoplanet atmospheres as a nice window into these individual worlds. And one of the goals here, right, is ultimately push towards studies of life and identification of life on exoplanets, right? This is kind of the holy grail goal at the end of the day. But along the way, we get to characterize all of these individual worlds and learn all about the diversity of planetary systems, which is also very exciting. By pushing towards characterizing these smaller and smaller planets, these super Earths that are just a little bit bigger than the Earth, that's gonna allow us to ultimately in the future be able to characterize true Earth-like planets around sun-like stars, and hopefully, you know, maybe hopefully find a planet like Earth that has life. That would be very exciting. Okay, so how do we study exoplanet atmospheres? I've focused on the transiting planets because these are these planets found via the transit technique are right now some of the best targets for atmospheric characterization, because we take advantage of the transiting geometry of these planets in order to characterize their atmospheres. We do this in two main ways. These aren't the only techniques that are used, but they're the ones that I'm going to talk about tonight. There's the transmission spectrum, which we obtain during transit. So we have the planet, it transits in front of its host star. Mostly you think of the transit as just blocking out some of the light from the host star. But also, it's kind of depicted in this image, some of the light from the star is going to filter through the upper atmosphere of the planet. And by doing that, because the atmosphere of the planet is made up of different atoms and molecules that absorb light preferentially at certain wavelengths and not others, you're going to get basically a chemical spectroscopic fingerprint of what the gases are in the upper atmosphere of that exoplanet. And that will allow you to constrain the composition and also the cloud properties and things about the temperature of the atmosphere of that planet. A second technique that is also used, also for transiting planet systems, is to look at the system at the secondary eclipse. So now this is point B up here. This is when the planet doesn't transit in front of its star, but half an orbit later, it disappears behind its host star. And that's the secondary eclipse. Right before the secondary eclipse, you're seeing the light from the star and from the day side of the planet that's facing you. And then that planet disappears, and now you're only seeing the star. Then the planet comes back, and now you're seeing the star plus the planet. So you can basically take a difference between the star-only image, or it's the light from the star only, and the light from the combined star and planet, and that will allow you to back out how much emitted or reflected light is coming from the day side of the planet itself. Okay, so the very first atmospheric observation made of an exoplanet smaller than Neptune, so one of these planets that I've been calling a super Earth, this very first observation was made in 2010. Prior to 2010, we had observed the atmospheres of larger exoplanets, hot Jupiters. But 2010 was the first time that we did atmospheric characterization of an exoplanet smaller than Neptune. The planet is called GJ1214b. This observation was made from the ground from the VLT, very large telescope. And we were hoping to see these spectroscopic signatures of absorbing gases in the upper atmosphere of this planet. But we didn't, actually. So the black points are our spectroscopic data. And hopefully kind of by eye, you can see that you can very easily shoot a straight line through these data points. So basically, we didn't detect any of the spectroscopic modulation that we would have expected if we were going to see absorption from the gases in the atmosphere. So that was a little bit of a bummer. It was not what we wanted. We hope to walk away saying we have detected these various gaseous species in the atmosphere of this planet. Instead, we did not. The constraint here was that we were able to rule out atmospheres on this planet that were hydrogen rich and cloud free. So clear atmospheres that were made of mostly hydrogen, which would indicate that this is something like one of these mini Neptunes or sub Neptunes, that this is a kind of the tail of the giant planet distribution. This is a planet with a hydrogen gas rich envelope. And we didn't see that. So moving forward, many other researchers tried to observe this same planet as well. And this result held up, basically. This very featureless, flat spectrum held up over other wavelength ranges, over other data sets obtained from other telescopes, from the ground and from space. Finally, in 2014, there was this great result published in the Nature Journal. This is, again, the transmission spectrum of the same planet, GJ1214b. And again, the spectrum is entirely featureless, except these data were obtained from space with the Hubble Space Telescope by observing 12 individual transits of this system and stacking them all together to basically make the error bars much smaller. So now these observations are much more constraining, and to the point that they not only rule out hydrogen-rich, cloud-free atmospheres, they also basically rule out almost basically any cloud-free atmospheres that you could come up with. A water vapor-rich steam atmosphere on this planet is ruled out. CO2-rich atmospheres are ruled out. Methane-rich atmospheres, if you could have such a thing, are ruled out. There's basically no atmosphere that is cloud-free that is consistent with the data. And the final interpretation here is that this atmosphere has a high up, thick layer of some sorts of clouds or haze that is basically blocking our view into the planet's atmosphere. And so we're not seeing the gases that are there because the atmosphere has a thick cloud or haze. So it's a frustrating result, but it is a positive detection of some sort of cloud layer on an exoplanet. And other such planets, these sort of sub-Neptune planets smaller than Neptune, but still kind of in the same size range, so kind of on the upper size end of the super Earth range. A number of these planets have now been observed, again, in transmission spectroscopy modes. And we kind of tend to see the mostly the same results, but not exactly. So we see other planets that have these very flat, muted transmission spectra, And we have others that that actually do show some sort of spectral modulation, but usually it's weaker than what we would expect for a clear hydrogen-rich gas giant planet-like atmosphere. And then the exciting thing about exoplanets is that there's a lot of them, right? So we can, in the solar system, we're stuck with just our eight planets, but with exoplanets, we can observe a lot of individual objects and try to understand what the atmospheres of these planets look like as a population. And so that's what we're starting to try to do with the exoplanet population in general. This is basically a summary slide of these transmission spectrum results for these sub-Neptune super Earth size planets. And so what we're seeing here, this is the amplitude of the spectral modulation from the transmission spectrum. Zero would be a completely featureless transmission spectrum. And you see that we get a lot of these planets that are revealing featureless or near featureless spectra. But not all of them. We have some planets that have these large spectral features, and we actually do detect gases in these planets, in particular water vapor for the plot that's shown here. And there's perhaps an interesting tantalizing trend with temperature, where the hottest planets show spectral features, and then all the cooler planets don't. They have these flat spectra. And with this kind of population study now, we can try to figure out what is the root cause here, right? With any one individual planet, we'd have trouble distinguishing exactly what is going on here. But with the population and this tentative trend with temperature, we can try to back out the root cause. And what we think it might be is that the muted spectra are caused in general by a photochemical haze, something like the hazes on, say, Titan. This would be a hydrocarbon, like soot particle haze that is readily forming in cooler atmospheres, but our chemistry models show that hydrocarbon hazes would not form readily in hotter atmospheres. So now we have a working hypothesis where we think that the hotter sub-Neptune planets should have clear atmospheres and the cooler planets should have hazy, featureless spectra. And so that's going to be our working hypothesis going forward. But this is kind of we've come up to date now. This is basically where we end. This is today. This is the status of things. These are the objects smaller than Neptune that we have characterized in this way. We've looked at a handful of even smaller planets, true rocky super Earths, but in those cases, a lot of the constraints are still tentative or not that useful because we don't have the data precision yet. So this is really kind of the state of the art atmospheric characterization of smaller planets than Neptune. And you can see we only still have kind of a handful of objects to observe. So part of what we'd want to do going forward is find more planets that are really amenable to these atmospheric characterization observations. And then we also need a better telescope even than Hubble and even than our current ground-based telescopes in order to do the atmospheric characterization. So that's actually gonna be the last portion of this talk, is that I'm gonna now focus on where we're going with all of this. And in the next decade, at least from the perspective of space-based characterization, the James Webb Space Telescope, JWST, is the facility that we're looking at. This is NASA's next flagship facility. It's the successor to the Hubble Space Telescope and the Spitzer Space Telescope. It is finally gonna launch, we think, later this year, hopefully by the end of October. And this facility will be just great for characterizing atmospheres of smaller planets. But I also name another facility here and another observatory here, and that's TESS. And TESS plays a really important role in our future atmospheric characterization of small planets. And that's because TESS is going to find the planets that we want to do the atmospheric characterization of. Basically, we need to identify more ideal targets in this super Earth size and mass range. And ideal targets means we want planets that we want small planets. If we want to characterize super Earths, we want small planets. We want small planets orbiting bright stars in the sky and typically also orbiting small stars, because for a given planet size, if the star is smaller, you're going to make a bigger transit and you're going to have a bigger atmospheric signal. So we need small planets orbiting bright stars and small stars. And that's what TESS is going to do. So TESS is an all-sky survey to look for transiting planets. It's flying right now. It's actually finished its nominal mission. It's in its third year of doing science. And this is a movie showing, a set of two movies showing the TESS observing strategy. So TESS has four cameras, it's about to show them. So yeah, 24 degrees wide, and then four cameras all stacked one on top of the other so that you observe from the ecliptic up to the ecliptic pole. And TESS will stare at one observational field that's shown on the slide right now for a month straight to look for transits of transiting planets around any of the stars in that swath of the sky. So for 30 days, if you observe for 30 days, you can find transiting planets with periods of up to 10 days or so. And then, next slide, then what happens? After 30 days, the camera shifts. So it does the next field in the sky and the next field and the next field. And so over the course of the year, every 30 days it moves and it gets the whole hemisphere. And then the whole telescope flipped over and 1 month at a time did the northern hemisphere. And you can see that there are these nice regions right at the ecliptic poles where you actually get full sky coverage over the entire year because all of the observational fields overlap. So the stars just in these orange regions get observed for a whole year straight in there. And there you can find planets on even longer orbital periods. But because TESS is specifically designed to find planets around all the brightest stars in the sky, this is going to provide us with the targets that we want to look at for atmospheric characterization efforts next with JWST. That's my next slide. There it is, the James Webb Space Telescope. Again, fingers crossed that it has a successful launch and deployment. This is a pretty recent image, I believe, with it's a telescope and the sun shield all put together. They've done tests to deploy the sun shield, and hopefully things are all looking pretty good and it's getting ready to get sent packing down to where it's gonna launch. Has to go through the Panama Canal and it's going to take a little trip off to its launch site. JWST is great because this is the comparative slide. The size of the mirror is about 6.5 meters in diameter compared to Hubble, which is 2.4 meters in diameter. So it's much bigger light gathering power. And then its wavelength coverage spans much of the infrared, and it has a nice complement of instruments that will be able to take spectra across the whole infrared part of the spectrum, which will allow us to detect all manner of molecules and heat infrared emission from exoplanets. So this is a great telescope, a great facility for exoplanet atmosphere studies. A word of caution, one thing that we will not do with JWST is actually characterize Earth-like planets. This is what the transmission spectrum of the Earth around the sun would look like. This is a theoretical model of the transmission spectrum of the Earth orbiting the sun. And you can see on the y-axis here, the size of any of these absorption features due to biomarker guesses like ozone, and methane. This is one part per million relative to the light from the sun. That is a very, very challenging measurement to make. JWST does not have this level of precision. The instruments themselves on JWST have intrinsic noise levels that are probably more like 10, 20, even 30 parts per million. So you never see a transmission spectrum like this. It would just be stuck down in the noise part of the data. But never fear, we can characterize the atmospheres of somewhat larger planets orbiting smaller stars, these so-called M-dwarf stars, which are smaller, cooler stars that have super Earths or sub-Neptunes in orbit around them. Those are really ideal systems for JWST for atmospheric characterization studies. And so that's the kind of science that we want to do, is look at super Earths orbiting M-dwarfs. Kind of philosophically, there's kind of two families of approaches that have emerged to how we want to think about pushing toward characterizing the atmospheres of smaller and cooler planets, and eventually pushing towards looking for things like signatures of life on exoplanets. And these two approaches are kind of laid out in a cartoon sense here. So the first one is called, has been kind of named, the system science approach. The system science approach is the one where you identify a planet that seems ideally suited, say, to hosting life. And you decide to kind of put all your eggs in one basket and say, this is the best target. We're going to take a whole sequence of observations, ever more detailed observations. We're gonna see if kind of each step of our experiment pans out. Does the planet seem like it could host life? Okay, now we'll do the next, now we'll do the next observation. Does it still seem like it could host life? And you do this whole sequence of observations. And then if everything all gives you thumbs up, at the end, you get to pop the champagne and say, we found life on an exoplanet, this is great. An alternative approach is a statistical approach. This is what I'm gonna call the statistical comparative planetology approach, where instead of focusing on individual ideal targets, you instead do coarse observations, but for a lot of planets. So you find one kind of easy observation to make that can be made quickly, and you do this for a lot of individual planets, say with slightly different properties. And what you're trying to do in this case is constrain some sort of theory of habitability. Does the ensemble of all of my results line up with the prediction of some theory about habitable planets and not line up with some alternative theory? So it's kind of two different ways to get at the kinds of scientific questions that we want to answer. I'll say that kind of from a discipline-related standpoint, this is more of the planetary, the system science approach is more of the planetary scientists approach, where it's kind of coming from a heritage of individuals who are used to doing detailed studies of individual solar system planets. Whereas the statistical approach is more of the astronomer's approach, where you think of astronomers who study, you know, who do like surveys of galaxies. This is that kind of scientific approach now applied to exoplanets. So it's just two different philosophies for going about the problem. And we'll probably use both at the end of the day, and they'll give us different types of information. So I'll just go through some examples of how this might work out. This is a simulated transmission spectrum, again, of a habitable zone super Earth planet orbiting the star TRAPPIST-1. This is the planet TRAPPIST-1e. E because it's what, B, C, D. It's the fourth planet found in the seven planet system. And the simulation is showing how you could use JWST to measure the composition of the atmosphere of this planet. You could distinguish between a water-rich atmosphere and a CO2-rich atmosphere, for example, and actually measure the abundances of water vapor or CO2 or maybe other gases in the atmosphere of this planet, tell if there's clouds, et cetera. One of the challenges here is that it takes a lot of observing time, right? To be able to build up the precision in the data, you need to observe not just one transit, but probably tens of transits to even more than 100 transits and stack all the data together to get these beautiful, exquisite spectra that we're seeing modeled here. And so this is a resource-intensive campaign on a single planet that is right now one of our very most promising targets for being a habitable zone exoplanet, where we actually think we could characterize its atmosphere with JWST. Okay, so now on the flip side, I'll give you an example of what we think we could do with the statistical approach. So here, instead of trying to find life on a specific planet, or trying to identify the atmospheric composition even of a single planet, here I'm asking a question that can be solved in more of a population level analysis. The question here is, do these super Earth planets, do these rocky planets orbiting M dwarf stars, do they have atmospheres? We want to characterize the atmospheres of the planets. Do they have atmospheres at all? And the reason we need to ask this question is that these M dwarf stars, these cooler, smaller stars, tend to be very active. We hear about solar flares. These are stars that have very prolonged high activity phases in their early lifetime, where they're giving off huge flares. They have very high flare rates, and these high energy particles that are coming off, and high energy radiation that's coming off the star is going to hit the atmospheres of the planets that are orbiting around those stars. And it could actually just strip the whole atmosphere away off of these rocky planets. And then there's no atmosphere left, and there's nothing left to characterize, and there's nothing left to support, you know, surface life. So this is a really important question to answer. Do the planets have atmospheres at all? And we came up with a nice observational test to try to answer that question. The observational test is, it's outlined here. I'll step you through it quickly. So the idea is that if a planet is a bare rock, if it has no atmosphere, the day side of that planet is going to be as hot as it can possibly be. That's basically because the light from the star hits the planet, and then the planet just re-radiates all that energy right back from its day side. But if your planet has an atmosphere, the atmosphere is gonna actually cool the day side of the planet in two ways. One is that the atmosphere will take heat from the day side and transport it around to the night side, the back side of the planet. And when it takes that energy away, it cools the day side. So the temperature of the day side drops. Also, if you have an atmosphere and there's any like cloud or haze particles, those particles will reflect and scatter starlight back towards the star, away from the planet. And so that energy never makes it into the planet's atmosphere to heat it. So atmospheres cool the day sides of planets. So we want to just measure, we basically want to do the thermometer test. We want to measure the temperature of the day side of the planet. If it's hot, the planet has an atmosphere. If it's colder, or sorry, if it's hot, the planet doesn't have an atmosphere. If it's colder, the planet does have a substantial or thick atmosphere. And we're going to do that through this secondary eclipse measurement. When the planet disappears behind its host star, or right before the planet disappears behind its host star, you're seeing the emission from the day side of the planet. And so the how big the secondary eclipse is now, this isn't the transit, but this is the secondary eclipse being modeled. The deeper secondary eclipse corresponds to a hotter day side of the planet. So if we measure, and this is actually a simulation for a real planet with JWST, if we measure a deep secondary eclipse, then we can infer that the planet doesn't have an atmosphere. And if we measure a shallower secondary eclipse, we can infer that the planet does have a thicker atmosphere. And so we want to do this now for hopefully lots of planets, measure the day side temperatures and see, do these super Earths have atmospheres or not? And are there some interesting trends? Say, you know, maybe the closest in planets don't have atmospheres, but planets that are a little bit farther, a little bit cooler and a little bit farther away from their host stars maybe do have atmospheres. Hopefully planets in the habitable zone do have atmospheres. Otherwise, these are maybe not the right planets to be looking for life. And the great thing about this technique is that we think we can make this binary distinction, has atmosphere or doesn't have atmosphere. We think we can do that with just observing a single eclipse for a lot of individual planets, up to 100 or more than 100 individual planets. These are simulations of the population of planets that the TESS mission should ultimately provide for us. And we think that we'll have about 100 planets where we can observe just one secondary eclipse each. And just with that data alone, we should be able to distinguish, does each of these planets have an atmosphere, not have an atmosphere? So that's something that we hope that we're going to be able to do. That's an investigation that we'd like to be able to do with JWST. And it takes, you know, the same amount of time to observe 100 eclipses, 100 individual eclipses for 100 individual planets, as it takes to observe 100 transits for one planet, which is what I showed you with the simulation of that TRAPPIST-1e before. All right, and now finally, wrapping up by moving even farther into the future, I wanted to get you all the way to what it will take to characterize the atmospheres of truly Earth-like planets. Earth-sized planets in the habitable zones of sun-like host stars, planets like us, just like us. And the roadmap all the way to that goal is still long, but we think we have a much better idea now of what it will take. The National Academies of Sciences put out a report now, I guess, 2 years ago, called the Exoplanet Science Strategy Report. And this report lays out the whole plan all the way to characterizing true Earth analog planets. And it's really beyond JWST, because JWST won't get us there, right? Beyond JWST, it's a two-pronged approach. There's observations that we want to make with ground-based facilities and with space-based facilities. From the ground, we can make further headway towards characterizing true habitable planets with the so-called ELTs, 30-meter class telescopes, even larger than our current telescopes. But there's construction of several of these around the world getting started or underway in various stages. With ground-based ELTs, we will be able to do, and we should be able to do, more characterization of now habitable planets orbiting these smaller, cooler M-dwarf stars. But to get all the way to Earth-like planets orbiting sun-like stars, we need yet another space-based mission, something beyond JWST. And in particular, the direction that seems the most promising right now is to launch a space-based direct imaging mission. Now this would not focus on transiting planets. This would be solving the much more challenging problem of imaging the Earth-like planets next to their sun-like host stars. This requires a very large telescope with technology that blocks out the light from the host star so that you can actually see those very faint planets in orbit around them. There's some different geometries that have been proposed. Some have internal coronagraphs where it's an internal instrumentation that will block out the light from the star. There's another possibility with an external star shade where you actually fly a shield in fly it separately, independently, and it will fly around and physically block out the light from the star so that you can see the planets in orbit. And either of these technologies should be able to ultimately bring true Earth analogs within reach. And there are mission concept studies within NASA for exactly what the architectures of such space-based direct imaging missions would look like, although they haven't been selected or funded yet. All right, so let's finish up with conclusions or summary points, takeaways from the first part of the talk, bringing us up to today. Small planets appear to be subdivided into a population of rocky super-Earths and larger gas-rich sub-Neptunes. The first observations of super Earth atmospheres revealed featureless transmission spectra and ultimately indicated the likely presence of some sorts of clouds or hazes. And we are finding that cooler planets seem to have less prominent transmission spectrum features, where we think that perhaps a photochemical hydrocarbon haze is perhaps the culprit for why this is happening. And for our future efforts, the JWST mission is going to provide us with an opportunity to characterize atmospheres of sub-Neptune and true and rocky super Earth atmospheres, especially for planets orbiting these smaller, cooler M-dwarf stars. And this is giving us the context for future studies of hopefully habitable terrestrial Earth-like planets in the future. We're going to do these atmospheric characterization studies from both a system science and a statistical comparative planetology approach. And there are relative merits to both approaches. And finally, the road all the way to characterizing habitable Earth analog planets is going to require a large space-based direct imaging facility in the future. I'll wrap up and take questions.
You have a question, go ahead and you can raise your hand and then we'll unmute, you can unmute yourself and share your video and ask the question. So, John, do you have a question?
Yes. Actually, I have two. One is whether or not the strengths and widths of the spectral lines together give you some information about the atmospheric density.
You want to know? Are you trying to distinguish like the surface pressure or just the density in general?
No. Whether or not there's enough atmosphere to indicate that it's probably being protected from the stellar wind.
So it is hard. Transmission spectroscopy usually probes atmospheric pressures of something like a millibar, and then it's harder to see, and then you don't really know what's going on deeper in the atmosphere because you don't see further in. So basically, it's hard to distinguish the absolute amount of atmosphere in general through these techniques. There are there's ongoing work to try to figure out some unique ways of constraining how much total atmosphere is on these planets. And actually, I think the secondary eclipse idea of, you know, the deeper secondary eclipse is corresponds to a planet with no atmosphere, and then ever shallower secondary eclipses correspond to thicker and thicker atmospheres. I think that's actually going to be the best way to get at how much atmosphere there is on any of these planets.
Okay, the other question is whether any of the cool atmospheres are cool enough so that the haze might consist of solid particles, which would produce polarized light, and that would tell you something about a magnetic field.
So the haze that we think is forming in these sub-Neptune atmospheres actually probably is solid particles, because the way that these hydrocarbon particles form, they form as solids, not liquid droplets. In general, particles are accompanied by the potential for a polarization signal. It's been modeled, and in practice, it's going to be really hard to get unique constraints. Things get washed out over the, because you're not resolving the system, and signal sizes are predicted to be very small. So again, people are trying to do this. If we're going to get polarization signatures from an exoplanet atmosphere, you'll probably first see it from a hot Jupiter. I think there've been some claims of maybe detecting polarization from hot Jupiter atmospheres, but it's still kind of challenging to back out that aerosols.
Yeah.
I see other hands. Elizabeth, are you calling on people or you're muted?
Go ahead, Wayne.
Okay. You say you're going to look for planets around bright stars. Is there a, or what is the magnitude range? And are you going to limit your examinations to certain spectral types?
Yeah, you're asking the theorist, not the observer. So I'm probably gonna punt on the question about the exact magnitude range. But I can tell you, so TESS doesn't make any cuts on spectral type, right? Whatever is basically more or less whatever's in its field of view. I mean, it images everything that's in its field of view. You know, as long as it's bright enough to be detected. There have been some decisions made to focus to basically take faster cadence observations of specific stars within each field, but those to span all spectral types, at least across main sequence stars, because I mean we want to find planets around all kinds of stars, definitely all kinds of main sequence stars. In terms of the brightness of the host stars, some of that is just, a lot of that's just set by what the optimal magnitude range is for tests to get, you know, high quality light curves. But there's another consideration when we do atmospheric characterization with JWST. JWST actually is not well suited to the very brightest stars. So there are stars that are, and there are planets orbiting some of these stars that are actually too bright for JWST. They'll saturate the detectors. We're not meant to point the telescope at them. So the very, very brightest stars are actually not good for JWST atmospheric characterization. They're great for ground-based characterization. And then there's kind of a whole swath across not the very brightest stars, but moderately bright stars that are better targets for JWST.
Okay. Right. Thank you.
Justin?
Hi. So you said that in the future, near future, when we launch JWST, that TESS is going to have the job to basically find the exoplanets that JWST wants to study. So what bottlenecks do you expect? Like, is TESS going to be slow or fast enough for JWST to be efficient in its studying? Or is JWST going to be the slower one than TESS?
This is a question I've actually spent a lot of time being really concerned about. So thank you for asking it. You've identified a real problem here, which is that if you think of TESS as the planet finder for JWST, you would want TESS to be, you know, done finding all of its planets before JWST ever launches. Instead, TESS has finished its nominal mission, but we're still confirming the planets from TESS, and JWST is going to launch soon. But I think the timing's going to be okay in the end. So we've gone through, as a community, we've been really trying to push the exercise of as soon as we have, we basically have a complete candidate planet list from TESS. Now that we have that list, we're trying to encourage the follow-up community, the people who are doing ground-based observations to confirm the planetary nature of the planets, we're trying to convince them to do their work most quickly on the planets that will be the best for JWST, so that by the time JWST launches and certainly gets into, you know, its first year of operations and beyond, that we have already identified the planets that we need to. But yes, there is a timing consideration there. It turns out that the delays of JWST have actually, for the kind of science that I'm interested in, for characterization of these smaller planets, I think the delays of JWST have actually worked out well. Because if JWST had launched like 2 years ago, we wouldn't have had the targets. We wouldn't have had the targets in place yet to the extent that we do now.
I also heard that M-dwarfs are rather hard to confirm, and because of their size. So are we going to be studying more like bright stars first and then M-dwarfs? Like, are we ever going to get to the point where we can readily study M-dwarfs?
The planets around M-dwarfs can be a bit harder to confirm, because one of the main ways that we confirm exoplanets is by measuring the masses of the planets through Doppler observations, through radial velocity observations, and those it is somewhat harder to make those measurements for M dwarf stars. But we have a lot of instruments coming online that again were really built to tackle that problem in particular. So we are being able to confirm a lot of the planets around the M dwarfs, and then those will become the ideal targets for JWST. And that's really one of the main scientific goals is to focus on some of those planets around the M dwarf stars, because they are for the smaller planets, at least they're the best targets.
Thank you.
Jeffrey Norman.
Yes. How far away are the most promising candidates of the Earth-like planets that we will be studying?
There's a planet orbiting Proxima Centauri, which is our closest star. So many of the closest stars to us have planets, and some of them are ideal atmospheric characterization targets as well. Nearby stars have some really great candidates for us to look at. Obviously those distances compared to anything that like we could ever travel or not, they're still practically very far away. Once you're out at light years away, that's very far away. But yes, the most nearby stars are still good candidates.
But they would be close enough that perhaps an intelligent civilization could make radio contact with
absolutely
us, mm-hmm, or we with them.
Yep, and no obvious signs yet. But SETI investigations. I mean, we're TESS is finding these planets around these very nearby stars now, and also improved radial velocity, improved Doppler measurements from some of these instruments that I was just referring to that are ideally suited to measure masses of planets around M dwarfs are also finding planets around a lot of these very nearby M dwarf stars to us. You could try to go looking specifically at them, or maybe they're looking specifically at us, who knows.
All right, any other questions? Come on, don't be shy. All right, then if not, then let's go ahead and give our speaker a nice round of applause. And you can unmute, or you can use one of the reactions.
Clap, 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 clap.
Clap, and.
That was a very, very good talk.
Yes, fantastic.
Wonderful, wonderful job.
Thank you.
Excellent talk, yes. Thank you.
Thank you.
Very usable for my astronomy 101 students. Later in the semester, it doesn't look like any of them showed up, but
I teach them. I teach
the recording. The recording can be used.
And so, with that, I do thank everyone for coming out, and we'll see you next month on March 13th. Okay, and then have a good evening. Do you have anything else, Harold? Any last minute? All right, then have a good evening. Thank you again, Elijah, for talking with us. And I look forward to seeing you again sometime in the office.
Yeah. Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, thanks.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Hey, thanks.
Bye, folks.